I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. In 1900, the average person could expect to live until their 47th birthday. By 2000, life expectancy was 77 years, an extraordinary gain of 30 years over the course of a century. Using those same metrics, many children today will live to be 100. So now that life is not so short for more of us, how should we rethink the aging process? What do we do with those extra years? How can we rebalance work, education, and family life? And how can we create quality out of quantity? There are challenges that come with getting older, most notably loss, and there are opportunities for growth. There are also baked-in prejudices about old people, and there's a premium, especially in America, on looking young, on being young. We have two guests who have joined us. And psychologist Laura Carsonson is a professor of psychology and founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. And Laura Carsonson, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Great to be with you.
And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is physician Lisa Walk. She's chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And Lisa Walk, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start with you, Laura, and just to take a moment to pause on this public health success of the 20th century, the fact that we were able to essentially add 30 years to a human being's lifespan. Is there a short answer for the reason for that?
It's a complicated answer, actually, but I'll try to make it as brief as I can. Many people credit medicine and medical advances to this increase in life expectancy, and medicine had a lot to do with it. But the changes were much broader. We purified the waterways. We put electrical systems in throughout the country, which meant we had refrigeration now in homes. We put education in place in every state. So there were a lot of factors that contributed to longer lives. But all together, they produced one of the most astounding cultural achievements in human history.
Well, you're a physician, Lisa. From your perspective, how do you see this public health success?
Well, I would agree with what's been said already. In addition, we typically think of the communicable diseases, infections and things that before would lead to someone's demise or illness or maybe chronic illness in lung, we've done a lot better with that. And so when you think of all the different vaccines and things we have now that prevent illness that in some cases would lead to death before, that's an additional contributor, as was already mentioned, to the kind of public health overall, but certainly what we've made advances within medicine.
Laura, now that we've got this so-called extra years, not for everybody, of course, and we will talk about that, but how should we sort of rethink then what the aging process is about?
I think we would do better to think about longevity than aging. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is longevity simply refers to the length of the life of something. It can be the longevity of your car. In this case, it's the species, right? And we have much longer lives. And the reason I say that may be a more productive conversation than aging is that we'll rethink all of life. And these 30 extra years can go anywhere we want. Right. So we have an opportunity to completely redesign how we live our lives from very early in childhood all the way through the end, so that they improve quality at all stages in life.
But are you saying that aging is a loaded word, Laura?
It's a loaded word, but I think it also focuses people on the second half of life. Right. And longevity is as much about the first half as the second half. We can live our lives differently as we work, as we have families. Education could change. You know, there are lots and lots of ways that we can change. The other thing I would add is that the aging process hasn't really changed very much, to the best of our knowledge, over 10,000 years. So we're aging the way we used to. What changed is the odds of us making it to old age. So it's the culture that we live in that is allowing us to live healthier lives, so we have longer lives. But the aging process is probably pretty much the same as it's been for thousands of years.
I'm thinking though, Lisa, I mean, for some people, they can live a long life, speaking about the aging process, yes. and a long mm-hmm. and healthy and productive and fruitful and happy life. But for other people, no, not so much. That the older you get, the more infirmed you are. Help us understand, I guess, this sort of dichotomy between these two processes of getting old or getting older.
Yes. Well, there are contributions from both your genes and your family makeup, as well as your environment, the social determinants of health, all of these come into play. And so, you know, they're typically someone will give a story of, oh, I, you know, had a friend or I knew someone that lived to 95 and they smoked and this.
Right. We know those stories.
We know those stories, right? And so so it's not the same across the board. It's not a guarantee that if you do X, Y, and Z, you will live to a certain age. And certainly there are people that we know that are doing healthy lifestyles and doing things who don't necessarily make it. And they could be from the same environment. They can have similar social determinants of health. So we cannot forget that there are the genes that we're made up with that do certainly have a contribution. But then there are things that we can do, irrespective of our genes, to live those longer lives, but also healthier, right? So in my field as a geriatrician, we're looking for wellness and as well as just longevity. We don't want to just be around. We want to be around and thriving and doing well. Right. So what are the things we can do to have the best quality for the life that we have?
So what are they?
Well, exercise is always high on the list. But I like to rephrase it, not because I think oftentimes when we say exercise, someone thinks they have to go to the gym and they're lifting weights and doing things. It's activity should really
movement,
be the way. Movement. Right? It's the movement. And having movement on a regular basis. And so movement as part of our life, not necessarily just something we do for a period of time and then go back to the regular sedentary life. And so if we think of it that way, how can we move? How can we be more active and engaged? And I tell my patients, just even starting off with small things, can you park the car a little bit further when you're going into the store, not always fighting for the closest spot? Can you get up and move a little bit more in the house? If your mailbox is at the end of your street, if you have one that you drive in, park your car in the garage and go back and walk for it. So start with just moving more, and then you know, you continue to increase from there. Certainly, if people are already exercising, I wouldn't say for them to stop. But if you haven't started to move, just start moving more.
Laura, let me turn back to you and picking up on what Lisa was saying there. And frankly, doing my homework, I kept coming across the same thing. Movement, eating a nutritious diet, don't smoke, don't drink too much. And the importance of having meaningful relationships or connections. The name of the show is The Connection. So relationships or connections. But I kept coming into that as a kind of not recipe for a healthier old age, but just words to live by. Can you add to that?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more with Lisa that it's exercise. You know, exercise, exercise, exercise. You know, if that were a pill, it would be the most sought after and expensive pill on the market.
Really?
Because it affects almost every organ system in our bodies. It affects brain and mood and bones. And so there isn't much you can do to improve your health than to exercise. And also, to Lisa's point, it doesn't mean going to the gym and, you know, pumping weights. It means moving. It means living a life where you're up and down and you're walking around. I think we need to think a lot about the built environment so that we live in places that encourage us to walk, more so than add more gyms to the neighborhoods so that we just have a life where we're moving a great deal.
Well, and picking up on that and going to you, Lisa, but I'm thinking of people who are older who are in pain or movement is difficult or, you know, they're disabled in some kind of way. I mean, movement then is going to be a much bigger struggle than the more healthy, active older person.
Yes, but we can all start where we are and make some improvements. And so perhaps if you can't move in the same way, but maybe you can do chair exercises. Certainly you can do water exercises. That takes away the gravity and a lot of the strain on the joints. And so sometimes it's just being creative or maybe adjusting the mindset of what you can do. There are certainly, you know, Tai Chi and other things that are other forms of movement that are more geared or situated for people who maybe can't do the same level of activity and have been shown to be very beneficial for balance and other things. So I think it's just a matter of thinking broadly, what do you enjoy? That's what I always start with people. It has to be something you enjoy. Because
sure.
If you don't, then it's just laborious. And so what do you enjoy? What do you get that kind of endorphin boost? And then if we need to, modify it. But everyone can do something.
Well, and going back to you, Laura, and thinking about not to focus entirely on movement, but movement gets your blood flowing, gets you out into the world a little bit more than if you're sitting at home, and meeting other people and having novel experiences. Can you add to that?
Yeah, and you know, some of the really good news is that you get the biggest bang for the buck in the first 10 minutes or so of movement. You know, we hear about 10,000 steps a day is the, you know, amount that people should be walking. There's no science behind that.
Oh, is that right?
That says 10,000. No, it was a marketing ploy for one of the first step counters that was ever put on the market. it does look like... We should be walking. So let me walk this back just a little. As I read the literature, you don't get a whole lot more gain past 7,500 steps. So that's a good bit of walking. But as I say, the biggest bang for the buck is that first 2,000 steps. It means basically get out of bed, start moving around the house, live an active life, and you'll start to get those steps. Now, if you do more, you will get some benefit, but the biggest benefit is what you get with the first first bit of exercise. So that's good news, I think, for people who are saying, oh, I couldn't possibly do all that they're telling me to do.
Almost up in a break here, but Lisa, it's interesting we're focusing, and I do want to move on, but it's interesting we're not focusing on diet. We're focusing on exercise, but is diet coming second?
Well, certainly diet is there as well. And when you were listing out before, Marnie, in terms of the kind of prescription of what they have to live longer, if you think, as you're saying, the blue zones of what we've seen of the areas where people live to 100 more than others and live healthy and to 100, the common factors that we see with those individuals are a constant moderate amount of physical activity, but also they typically tend to be more plant-based or heavier plant-based in terms of their diets. And so and focusing on sleep and just being basically kind of well-rounded. So it isn't just one thing, but certainly a diet and having a diet that is heavier on the plants, heavier, less with the fats and things like that, or healthy fats if we're doing it in moderation, is certainly part of the combination as well.
Well, let's take that very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's physician Lisa Wolf, chief of the of geriatric medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Psychologist Laura Carstensen is with us as well, professor of psychology at Stanford University and founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. We're talking about longevity and aging. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking about longevity, how to find meaning and purpose while managing the inevitable losses that come with age. And again, our guests are physician Lisa Walk and psychologist Laura Carstensen. Laura, let me go back to you, and you have talked about the need to kind of, if people are living longer, and clearly most people are, the need to sort of redraw, I guess, the map of what it is to be to live a life into, let's say, the 80s, 90s, maybe even into the 100s, and to think about career differently, think about education differently, even family life. Let's start with career. In a perfect world, how would we do that if we're, you know, living, let's say, to a healthy 85 years old?
Yeah, well, I've been telling people lately that I think we should all retire early and often, meaning that we're going to come in and out of the workforce a lot, I think, in the future, which also means that we have to change our education system so that we're going back and learning new skills so that we can go back into a workforce even better prepared. we developed at the Stanford Center on Longevity the New Map of Life initiative because all these factors are connected to the others. Financial security is also very much connected to people's health and well-being, as is education, as social relationships, and so on. And so we thought to just focus on any one of them or focus on a set of them as if they're independent, we needed to begin to think about how they interact. And so that's what we've been doing at the center, is to draw a new map, a map with lots of on-ramps and off-ramps and that twists and turns. Probably the greatest gift that we'll get from longer lives is the opportunity to be more flexible in how we live our lives. The old model is a model that was built around lives half as long, right? And that model says you get your education early, then you work like a dog, and if you're lucky, you launch a couple kids from the home, retire for a couple years, and then you die. I mean, that's all there was time for. And now that kind of a life course, it doesn't support 100-year lives. It certainly will undervalue the opportunity. But we can't have lives, we can't sustain lives, let me say, financially or emotionally, socially, where we pack all of life into the first half and then we just kind of sit it out for the second half. That's just untenable.
Well, and I wonder, Lisa, as I mean, you work with patients, so you're obviously dealing with people who are dealing with health issues, but it's interesting to think about retirement. I know people that say, these are the best years of my life, you know, being retired. And I know people who are struggling because they don't know what to do with themselves, or they don't know who they are, you know, without a job attached to them. How do you see people struggling with that?
Well, I would agree with the assessment that you had. And funny enough, I just had a conversation with someone along these lines yesterday. I think as we had started off in the first portion of, if we thought about longevity and that we could have 10, 20, 30 years during that retirement phase. So if you're thinking in that regard, how do you plan for that? What do you want to do during that time? And the conversations I have with individuals, because by the time I'm seeing them, you're already in that phase, is focusing on what do you enjoy? Most people, even if they want to work, they don't want to have that same kind of schedule, right? They don't want to have to, I have to go in every day, maybe part-time. But even that sometimes kind of the thought of having to come in when I don't feel like it. Folks don't like that. That's fine. Can you volunteer? Can you teach a course, right, that you get to set the schedule and do things? And so I encourage people to do that. What is it that you enjoy? That's the best part of this phase, right? You don't have to do the things you don't want to do. Focus on the things you do, and how can you emphasize that? Maybe it's teaching the next generation. Most people, when they get older, one of the things that is a common theme is you want to feel like you're still contributing to society. And a great way to contribute is by sharing your wisdom and your knowledge with someone else. So how can you do that in a structure that works for you?
Laura, I was reading some research coming out of Stanford, your center there on longevity, and apparently there is some cognitive decline when people do retire, maybe measurable cognitive decline. Can you speak to that?
Sure. It does look like work is good for people. And that's in terms of physical health, physical strength, as well as cognitive health and social connections. I think the way I think about work is that we don't work very well in this country. So work is good for you. The way we work in the United States is not. And that, by that, I mean we work way too hard in the middle and then not at all after retirement. That's kind of the basic model. And what we could be doing is to optimize the benefits we get from work. Cognitive sharpness, engagement, being some of those, by smaller doses of work, but more years of work. I think we'll come to a time where retirement will not be something associated with chronological age as strongly as it is today. People will retire, but they'll retire because they want to, or they'll retire because they're sick. But there'll be a lot of other reasons for retirement other than chronological age.
Do you think we're a kind of country that We'll do that, Laura. We're such a, as you mentioned, we're just such a pro-work country. And pro-work your butt off country.
We are. You know, I get inspired by the students I teach. We teach a course on longevity at Stanford to undergraduates, and the course is arranged to be all about them. So, you know, they're first a little bit surprised. They may come to the course thinking this is going to be about their grandparents. And it's right. This is about you, your generation, and what does your future look like? And when they begin to see what the opportunities are, they get really excited about different kinds of careers, about businesses, about family life, about having multiple occupations and vocations, just having more time. I mean, that's what we've been given. We've been given a gift of time, and it's up to us to make sure that we use that gift well.
Well, I'm working with older patients. They have a view, Lisa, of time that's different from an 18 or 20-year-old. I'm thinking of myself. I'm 75 years old. You know, my time is getting shorter every single day. I am very aware of that. I'm not obsessed with death, but I'm very aware of my mortality.
Yes. I would like to say that I think that generationally there is a difference of how work-life balance is thought of, which is a concept, quite frankly, that was not one, if you are from the greatest generation or baby boomers. Work-life concept or work-life balance is a new term and phrase. I think when we look at millennials, when we look at Gen Zs, they are growing up with that and they are protective of that, of having that work-life balance. So as when you were mentioning before, when you get to retirement, if you haven't had anything besides work and there wasn't much of that life aspect, that's where it becomes challenging. What do I do now, right, if I'm not working? I think we're going to see a shift as these younger generations get older and they throughout their life have been trying to balance their work with their life. Retirement will likely look different for them because now they know the life part just gets to expand even further than they've already been expanding it. So I suspect we're going to see some differences over the next couple of generations.
I mean, Laura, I'm thinking of today's, you know, 30, even 40-year-olds having children. And so that is shifting, you know, when all these milestones have been rather than having children in your early 20s, for instance.
That's right. We are seeing first births at later ages. It isn't a huge change, but we are seeing it inch later in life. I have a prediction there that I think we're going to circle back on that.
Okay.
That we're still at a stage where we're thinking we have to accomplish what we need to do in our careers before we can have children. And I think that as we get used to these longer lives and see that lives are going to be more marathons and less sprints, that we'll be able to say, I think I'll have a kid now before I start my career or before I go this direction in my career. And so I think we'll actually see some changes in that over time. Right now, we're still trying to kind of live by the old model of life. And I think we'll begin to see those rules relax.
Well, I sure hope you're right. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Laura Carstensen, and she is she's a professor of psychology at Stanford University, founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Lisa Walken. She's chief of geriatric medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. I'm thinking, too, of those people who have, and I'll look at you, Lisa, but that, Laura, I want to get you back in on the conversation as well, who are in that sort of middle age. They have parents in their 80s, maybe their 90s, maybe even into their 100s. They've got children that are either in school or on their way into the workforce, having to make really difficult decisions for their parents that they dearly love, but they see them declining. And I think it's one of the hardest decisions you have to make as an adult, which is, how do I help my aging parent when the options seem limited and you can see they're suffering and you want to do the best for them? And sometimes it's hard not to know what to do.
That's true. Yeah. I think that part of it is knowing what resources are available. And certainly if you haven't had to utilize them or to investigate or look until this point in time, and now you're at this stage where there's maybe more help that you need, or and maybe sometimes you don't even know what it is you need, but you know you need something. hopefully that's when you have an opportunity to connect with a geriatric specialist, you know, geriatric medicine, social work, someone who is familiar with the landscape, what resources are available, what differences, modifications can be made to the person's home, perhaps to keep them safe or to add in these activities or other things that will have fulfillment. So I think that the challenge becomes you get to that stage and you haven't gone there before, and maybe there aren't as many groups or connections. You know, when you're younger and you're raising your kids, there's the mommy and me, and you have your other friends, and they can tell you kind of how they're maneuvering it. And you get to this stage, maybe more at midlife, and you're now trying to figure it out for your parent. You may not have any peers or friends who have done this before to guide you in the same way as you did when you were trying to raise your own children. We are out there. It may just be that your peer group doesn't know how to connect you. And so I would say that would be an opportunity to realize there are people who have done this and have been doing this. Can I get tied in? Can I get connected to them to get the help I need? So I'm not just trying to struggle and do it myself. I see that so often the first time I'm seeing a patient and they come in maybe with an adult child and they're just weary because they've been trying to do everything themselves. And within a visit or two, I can say, well, no, you know, we can help with this. We can do that. And they're like, oh, it's just like literally a weight that they were carrying on their own and they didn't have to, but also didn't realize that it was a weight till some point in time.
I mean, Laura, this is a tough conversation to have, and I've had it with older parents and grandparents where you know, you have to, in a sense, read the Riot Act, but at the same time, you see a person in crisis because of their dealing with their various infirmities.
It's really hard. It's a really difficult place to find oneself in, both as an older parent who needs some help and an adult child who wants to help. You know, most people who are caregivers say that it's one of the most valuable times in their life, that they wouldn't trade it. They aren't trying to get rid of this opportunity. They want to do it. But as Lisa said, they need help. People can't do these kinds of things on their own. And I would go so far as to say we don't have very good, well, we have insufficient support services, let me say.
Yes.
We need to have better ones. It's a great business opportunity for people to think of services that they can provide for people. All of us at some point, almost all of us, are going to be caregivers at some point in our lives and going to be cared for with a little luck, you know, at some point in our lives. So it's something we really need to think about and think about what the best ways we can provide support for people who are in those situations. I don't think we've done a good job. We have assumed that the caregiver will be the daughter. And if there's not a daughter, the daughter-in-law. If there's not a daughter-in-law, maybe a niece.
All girls, by the way, for our listeners, yes.
But these responsibilities tend to fall down gender lines. That's becoming a little softer these days, too. We're seeing more men involved, but it's still primarily women and, importantly, primarily relatives. Hmm. And with the fertility rate, what it is, this is untenable in the future. We cannot assume that there will be adult children living nearby ready to step in and provide a great deal of service and help to older parents. So we've got to consider blends of familial and non-familial approaches, and we need to think about services that formal services that people can access.
Laura, let me just toss something back at you, and Lisa, I want to get you in on this as well, but I'm thinking then you have to be able to have a conversation about either end of life care or, you know, what happens if, or what do you want when? And those are difficult conversations to have, especially if people are in denial or, you know, they don't want to face what's going on in their life. Totally understandable. But, and I speak a little bit from experience, having dealt with family members who, you know, it's a difficult conversation to have. Go ahead, Laura.
Well, I think the way to have these conversations is to start them early, so that we're talking about this a lot throughout our lives, long before we need it or your parents need it, and so that we're thinking about it and the conversation itself isn't taboo. It doesn't mean it's the end of your life when the conversation is first raised. So I think we need to talk lots more about it. And we also need to know, you know, we provide care a lot, not just for older parents. It's for children, for example, neighbors. We are by nature humans. We are caregivers. Hmm. We tend to care for other people. We're drawn to it. We want to help other people. Right now, the problem is we make it too hard. So people want to help, but it's too hard. The demands are too great. And so I think we need to really think about what a caring society looks like. And, you know, people are worried about AI taking jobs away. Right. Well, they're not going to take the caregiving jobs away. And so I think it's actually an opportunity to think of, what are those human skills and strengths that we can use to make the world better for people around us.
Sure. Go ahead, Lisa. I see you nodding.
Yes. What I wanted to say, part of agreeing with what Laura was saying, is to normalize the conversations. And so medically, we are trying to do this by having these conversations earlier on. As a geriatrician, what we focus on is we have this whole movement, age-friendly movement.
And age-friendly?
Age-friendly, the age-friendly health system. We're trying to promote that and have more age-friendly health systems. And it focuses on the four M's. One of the M's is what matters. What matters to you as an individual? And so when we have these conversations, and I recommend this to my family members who are whoever is going to be a decision maker, start off with what matters. And that's what I discuss with my patients. Rather than do you want this, this, or this, what things do you value? What gives you pleasure? What gives you joy? What makes you feel fulfilled? Once I know those things, I can help make decisions for you medically or recommendations because I keep that at the center. And so I think that's the same conversation that whoever it's helping to make, whether it's family or someone else, instead of making it so difficult, do you want me to do this? Do you want me to do that? We don't think in terms of interventions as individuals. We think, I want to be able to, you know, go spend time in the garden. Okay, well, I know that if we go down this path, you're not going to be able to do that, right? I want to be independent, that I hear a lot. So then I know if we're doing things that are going to negatively impact your independence, that's not something you want. So starting off with what matters to the person really helps with these conversations.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Lisa Walk and Laura Carstensen about longevity, about some of the challenges and opportunities and wonderfulness of getting older, of being older. And Laura Carstensen is founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. Lisa Walk, chief of geriatric medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Today on The Connection, we are talking about longevity and what happens when we get older, how to find meaning and purpose in life, how to stay in relationship with others, how to manage the inevitable losses that come with age. And again, our guests are physician Lisa Walk and psychologist Laura Carstensen. Lisa, right before the break, you said there are four M's. You gave us one. What matters? What are the three other M's?
The other three M's are mentation. So trying to improve someone's mentation, mindset, avoiding things that will impact or negatively impact our mentation, our thinking or mind.
Mentation meaning thinking.
Like mind, if you want to do it that way, yep. So to speak. Mobility. So what can we do to help improve our mobility and encourage us to be mobile? Again, trying to avoid things that take away from that. And the last one is medication. Mm-hmm. So limiting medications. As geriatricians, we deprescribe often and take away medications that someone is either no longer needs or is not benefiting from. And when we're making a choice for medications, being mindful that it doesn't impact one of those other M's, that it doesn't stop us from doing what we like to do, or it wouldn't be something that would make us less mobile or something that would make us confused. So those are the four.
Fair enough. Laura, let me go to you and let's talk about happiness. And there are these various scales of happiness. How do older people do on that scale or those scales?
better than any other age group.
Really?
economists have studied something called the life satisfaction, and there's a U-shape to life satisfaction where it's high early in life and then goes down in midlife and then starts to come back up again later in life. But emotion researchers, if you're just asking about happiness, not life satisfaction, then we see linear improvements from early adulthood forward, that we're seeing better well-being emotionally in day-to-day life. And it isn't so much that people are happier and happier and happier. It's that they're less likely to be angry, to be fearful, to be sad. And so what we see is a reduction in the negative emotions in day-to-day life. Life satisfaction, the reason we see this difference in the U-shaped curve versus this linear one, is that life satisfaction is about a cognitive assessment of your life. How are you doing compared to other people? Or just how are you doing yourself? That's not an emotion. It's a judgment about your life. And that's why we see those differences.
That's fascinating. Let me read a quote from Oliver Sacks, a famed neurologist. I was lucky enough to interview him on several of his books, but I ran across this quote from him. He says, at nearly 80, with a scattering of medical and surgical problems, none disabling, I feel glad to be alive. I'm glad I'm not dead, sometimes bursts out of me when the weather is perfect. I'm grateful that I've experienced many things, some wonderful, some horrible. Then he goes on to say, I am sorry I've wasted and still waste so much time. I'm sorry to be as agonizingly shy at 80 as I was at 20. I'm sorry that I speak no languages but my mother tongue and that I have not traveled or experienced other cultures as widely as I should have done. And Laura, I like that quote because it's both this joy and regret and wonder and appreciation. Yes. I mean, he's a gifted writer, obviously, but yes. can you expand on that for us?
Yes, and it is a beautiful selection of his, because he does capture the positive aspects of aging and the less positive aspects of aging. And the great thing about aging and emotion is that we tend to accept them all bundled together. So it isn't that we're striving to be, again, as happy as we could possibly be. Mm-hmm. It's, I think a better description of emotion in later life is complex, emotional complexity, emotional richness. I think often, you know, like a 5-year-old child doesn't look at their puppy running around the yard and get a tear in their eye.
No, they don't.
They're just happy, happy, just sad, right? It's one or the other. You know, it's like a switch. But for older people, they do. And it's among the richest emotional states that we have as humans.
Because it's complex, right? It's not either or. It's this mix of emotions. Lisa, go ahead.
Well, that's true of longevity or aging, the last part of our lives, or the last third, or however you want to phrase it. It's complex. That's why we say, as geriatric specialists, we're complexists, right? We deal with a lot of
different... You say that about yourself.
Yes. Yeah. We deal with a lot of complex issues. And that quote, I loved it so much, because that's part of the reason why I went into geriatrics as a field. I felt I was benefiting from interacting with people who felt that way and were willing to share that with me, so that I could live my life in a manner that... not having some of these regrets, right? Learning from these things and doing things. And so I agree that there is that complexity, that at one point it's the golden years, and in some other cases people are like, this is horrible, you know, but you can kind of weather and see through all of that and usually at the end still come through on the positive side, despite these other things that might not be good. Overall, I'm grateful for where I am and still have time to improve and do other things.
Laura, is that wisdom? Are we talking about wisdom here?
I don't know. I think it's more what you were talking about a few minutes ago, Marty. It's approaching the end of life, and it looks like rather than that instill a kind of sense of panic or sadness or fear, it leads people to savor the days that we have. And so we tend to look on the positive side of life as we get older. We notice the blue sky and the bird and the limb in the tree outside your office window. You notice these things more. And I think that's what later life sort of well-being is about.
And Laura, going back to you as a psychologist, I mean, as human beings, do we, I mean, we can and do change over time, but are we essentially the same person at 90 that we were at 30? Go ahead.
Oh, what a good question. in terms of personality traits, there's a lot of consistency. So if you've always been an extrovert, you'll probably be an extrovert when you're 90. If you've always been a worrier, you'll still be a relative worrier when you're older. But people change in a lot of ways other than personality traits. And that, I think, actually comes to wisdom. Wisdom refers to large bodies of knowledge about everyday life, coupled with knowing how to play those cards. Mm. So it's not just knowing what life is like and what the right choices are. It's having a sense of being able to do that. And I think that better captures wisdom. And I think a lot of people do achieve that. And trust me, age is no guarantee that you're going to achieve it. So not everybody gets there. But I think age gives us the opportunity to achieve wisdom.
I mean, Lisa, by the time you're 80, hopefully you know some things. You've learned some things from life,
yes.
Right?
Yes. But I did want to add, it is a choice, right? We still have the opportunity to how do we want to view those experiences that we have. And while I would like to say that everyone has this great acknowledgement and appreciation for the various things we, as we've been talking, that is not true across the board.
Right.
And so I think we also need to recognize that we still have that ability to say, I've had these losses, but, or you can just say, I've had these losses, and period, and stop there. So that's still the opportunity within our grasp of how we want to view our 80 years and how we want to view potentially the next 20.
And Laura, I'm thinking if people are living, you know, we're comparing 1900 to 2024, but nonetheless living decades longer, you need money. I mean, we haven't talked about money yet, but you need money in order to support yourself for a long time.
Yeah, Lisa, when you were naming the three M's, I thought your last one was going to be money.
Money, right.
I like medication, too. That's nice.
Let's do money. Go ahead.
Might have to add one.
Yeah, exactly. Five M's now. But go ahead, Laura.
Money makes a huge difference. And in fact, we would need another hour to discuss the disparities we see in this country especially. Okay. But your wealth influences how many years you're going to live, and the quality of your physical health during those years. And one thing to keep in mind as we talk about longer lives is that these longer lives are not coming to everyone, and they're not being distributed evenly or fairly. In the United States, the vast majority of increases in life expectancy since the 1980s have gone exclusively to the college educated. Yeah. And so we see real disparities. Zip codes predict your life expectancy. And it's uncanny, and it's kind of terrifying when you look at the magnitude of those differences. That's something we really need to think long and hard about in this country. And not just to think about the problem, but to think about ways that we can use longer lives to ensure that all lives can be higher quality.
Sure, all lives matter. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yes, and I would agree with what's been said, but in addition, we don't have to stop there. There are things we can do to improve upon that. And so the government, HRSA, is funding a geriatric workforce enhancement program. It's a funding mechanism award where we try to integrate geriatrics in primary care, but also we try to educate older adults and everyone that's interested in aging about the things that we can do. We're fortunate we just received one at Penn, and part of what we're doing, one of the partners we're working with is one of our sister organizations at Penn, Urban Labs, where they turn spaces that were not maybe walkable, usable into like green spaces in within our urban areas, because we know then people can walk more and they can get out and they can get some of these different improvements that we said. And that's irrespective of what zip code you're in. Can we bring what we know is beneficial to you? I'm partnering with them to say, could we then make sure that those are spaces that all ages can use and enjoy? So we have to start with where the problems and the issues are, but we don't have to end there. We certainly should be doing things to, if we can, level the playing field, right? So it doesn't matter as much, although it does a lot now, how much money you have. Can we put some of the things that we know work into an area that maybe doesn't have those resources to help level out? There's more of those things we could and should be doing.
Well, speaking of all ages, and Laura, going back to you, and you see, you know, retirement communities where people, older people are all living together. Is that a healthy thing? How important is it for people of all ages to interact, to have, you know, friends that are 40 years older or 40 years younger? How important is that to someone's longevity and sense of well-being and connection, I should add?
So people who live in retirement communities, age-segregated retirement communities, right, are happy living there. People who live in their own homes in the communities where they've lived for decades are happy there. So my point here is there's hopefully we'll never do that random assignment to group study, which would be wildly unethical, right?
It would be, yes.
People tend to live where they want to live. But what it tells us is that there are some people who are very happy to live in a retirement community where there are services provided, where there are people their own age that they can talk with. Most people, however, and when I say most, surveys suggest about 85% of people say that they want to grow old where they live in middle age. That is, they want to stay in their own homes. I think what we will see in the future as businesses develop to support staying in one's own home, we'll see people stay there much more than moving to communities that are specifically designed for older people. Age diversity appears to benefit people, from the young children who have older people around to the older people having younger children around. It's good all around. So I think we'll move more in that direction, mostly because that's what people say they want.
Right. And I wonder, Laura, whether, you know, AI can help there. I mean, we have little robots who are, you know, helping take care of the apartment.
Absolutely, AI will help. It's one of the areas where we're going to see huge assistance. And a lot of it is surround safety. So for most people, through most of their old ages, right, let's say if old age starts at 65 and you're going to live to be 90, that's a lot of years, right? It's not like you need to move into the nursing home or a retirement community when you're 67 or, you know. So most of those years will be healthy. But most of those years will also come to be years where it'd be nice to have somebody carry the groceries or help you move a box from one room to another in your home. People need help. And I think we'll begin to see those kinds of things, those kinds of needs identified through AI. And we'll see better provision of services because we'll be able to target them better.
No, that's fascinating. We're almost out of time here, Lisa. And we haven't really, and we've touched on the importance of relationships, but I want to make sure that we give that at least some spotlight as we talk about the importance of health and longevity.
Yes, and as you were saying, connectedness, right?
And connectedness,
so having that connectedness and is definitely one of the aspects, again, and when you look at the places that people live longer and live healthier, that's one of the things that they have connections. And so if you don't naturally have them or within their family, you can create them. And that's where, for some people, going to a senior community gives you that connection. If you don't have that, you might find it in other ways, a social group or a religious community or other things of just having that connectedness. We are people that tend to like to be in groups and like to be able to share what we know and to hear from other people. It definitely keeps our brain sharp. It keeps our body moving. And so not everyone feels that way, but certainly most people do want to have some connection. So that can't be underestimated. And it can happen at any point in time.
Absolutely. Laura, I'm giving you the last word, and you got 30 seconds. Go ahead. Connections, right? People, relationships. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, in some ways, it's what's the point of these longer lives if we don't have strong connections to other people? That is what we strive for as humans. We connect to other people. We love other people. Spending time with them and being with them is something that we'll now get to do longer than our ancestors did in the past. So it's a great gift, and we really need to be thoughtful about how we use these added years to make sure that we realize the gift.
A perfect place to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on The Connection. Laura Carstensen, and thanks so much for joining us, especially during your vacation.
My pleasure.
And she's a professor of psychology at Stanford University, founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. Lisa Walk, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And she's chief of geriatric medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And thank you for joining us on The Connection. It airs Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook, and check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.